From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Trump clinches the Republican nomination. Obama visits Hiroshima. Clinton's emails under fire, and Bill Cosby will stand trial. Yesterday, Donald Trump reached the 1,237 delegates necessary to win the GOP nomination and kept right on attacking Hillary Clinton.
Here I am watching Hillary fight, and she can't close the deal. And that should be such an easy deal to close.
The State Department Inspector General says Hillary Clinton was wrong to use that private email server, that she had no legal clearance. She looked for the bright side.
This report makes clear that personal email use was the practice for other secretaries of state, but it was still a mistake.
And President Obama visits Hiroshima, Japan, where the age of nuclear warfare began with a flash, a mushroom cloud, and mass death.
Mere words cannot give voice to such suffering. But we have a shared responsibility to look directly into the eye of history.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Dimitri Sevastopoulou of the Financial Times, Juana Summers of CNN, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you see the president's visit to Hiroshima? The polls showing Clinton and Trump edging closer in a general election. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Dimitri, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Also from Washington, we have Juana Summers with us, editor at CNN Politics, where she's been covering the 2016 election. Juana, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Juana, and Dimitri.
Let's go back to Hiroshima for just a moment. Here's the president, the first sitting U.S. president to visit, laying a wreath at the memorial site of America's 1945 atomic bombing, first of Japan. He said the world cannot afford to let the memory of that bombing fade.
On a bright, cloudless morning, death fell from the sky, and the world was changed. A flash of light and a wall of fire destroyed a city and demonstrated that mankind possessed the means to destroy itself.
And next to the American president, the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, also laid a wreath, talked about the meaning of today's visit.
This gives great hope to people all around the world who have never given up their hope for a world without nuclear weapons.
Dimitri, you spent years in Japan, so did I. 5 years in Tokyo, you've been to, I'm sure, Hiroshima, so have I. Tell us how you think this is likely seen and heard in Japan today, Dimitri.
Well, I think the visit from the Japanese perspective went extremely well. It's hugely symbolic. This is the first visit by a sitting president to Hiroshima. There for years had been a kind of a controversial diplomatic discussions in the background about whether a U.S. president could ever go there if they didn't apologize. A deal was done so that Obama could go there without giving an apology. And all the reports in the Japanese press pretty much show that it went down extremely well. And I think the kind of symbolic image of the visit and the laying of the wreath at the Peace Memorial is when he hugged one of the victims of the atomic bomb being dropped, the hibakusha, as the victims are called. And I think that image is something that has been spread across Japan and all of the media sites and has had a really big impact on the Japanese people.
Juana Summers, the American president did not have to go to Hiroshima. This American president decided to do it. How do you read that?
He didn't have to go. I think my biggest takeaway as I was listening to what the president said there is his call for a world without nuclear weapons. This visit to Hiroshima, of course, is part of his larger mandate with this trip to Asia and his constant insistence that American foreign policy has to move away from the traditional hotspots in the world like the Middle East and Europe, instead towards the nations across the Pacific Ocean. So it's really a landmark occasion. You know, it's been years since an American president has since this bombing has happened, and an American president has never gone there. Obama making history and trying to go out on this legacy of talking about making the world a safer place, even as we deal with these conflicts overseas every day.
Jack, how do you see this tableau? I mean, it was remarkable when the American president hugged the survivor of the nuclear bombing. Also remarkable standing next to the leader of Japan and them shaking hands on this site after laying wreaths. The president made subtle reference, and maybe not so subtle, to Japan's also bloody role in World War II. But, of course, the atomic bomb is something else. And that was at the heart of his point, saying we need a moral revolution to keep up with our own technological advance. How did you read the tableau there today, Jack?
Very moving, and in a historic way. The president really strikes noble notes, but a world free of nuclear weapons, have we advanced in that direction under the president? His critics point out that we have, in fact, embarked on a trillion-dollar modernization of the nuclear arsenal, which will feature weapons that some say could be destabilizing. On the other hand, this president, we read today, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, has reduced the nuclear arsenal less than any of his immediate predecessors. We're just slow in cutting older and eliminating older weapons. So he calls for a world free of nuclear weapons, yet he builds more and retires fewer.
Dmitry, what do you think of the president's message if it's not coupled with actual nuclear arms reduction by the United States, the country, of course, that dropped the bomb?
Well, I mean, that's one thing that critics in Japan will also point out. And, you know, one of the things that he said in his speech at Hiroshima was, you know, the need to eliminate the existence of nuclear weapons. That went down very well with the Japanese. It figured prominently in Japanese media. But it's interesting for the Japanese perspective. They see President Obama talk about this, notwithstanding what he has or hasn't done back in the U.S. And they contrast that with Donald Trump, who, you know, just weeks ago said that Japan and South Korea should both consider developing nuclear weapons to help them defend themselves against North Korea. So there's a kind of a contradiction here, which is, you know, this current administration is saying one thing, and potentially the next administration, the next president, could say something completely different. So, I mean, that just kind of highlights what a kind of a difficult issue this is for everybody.
One, it is striking that two absolute adversaries in war could, and it is 71 years, that's a long time, but nevertheless, stand there at this observance as allies now with a kind of common understanding, the president saying, let's do more than be rid of nukes, let's be rid of war.
Absolutely, and this just shows that how much has changed in those 70-plus years. I think what we saw from the president today and during this visit in Hiroshima was a very choreographed visit, as Dmitry noted, something that there had been a lot of calculation over whether or not there is an apology. The president, of course, going without making that at the site of this bombing, which killed over 100,000 Japanese people. I think it's really a reflection of what Obama wants to leave as his foreign policy legacy as well, and we'll be seeing more things like this coming from him in the next couple of weeks and months ahead as he winds out his final term.
Let's get a couple of calls on this one. Iowa City, Rob is calling. Hi, Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, what do you see, Rob?
So I continue to be impressed by President Obama's profound and nuanced comments on complex subjects. And, you know, I'm just really going to miss him once he's out of office in January.
Miss him because he's able to step into an arena like Hiroshima and speak at length with the kind of grace and subtlety. And that is impressive. What about Jack Beatty's point that there hasn't been a matching decrease or real move on American nuclear arms?
You know, I think that's a fair criticism, and that's something that Obama's going to have to face in his legacy. But I think that his emphasis on the future and on America being a leader is where we should place our emphasis.
Rob, I appreciate your call. I mean, Dmitry, it is notable. And, of course, the president, ever since his Nobel Peace Prize speech, mocked on this as well. But this is a president capable of taking on very thorny issues in a very nuanced way. And we're put that up against a campaign where we're seeing some really harsh rhetoric, blunt rhetoric, anything but nuanced. And I think many will see that, that will draw that distinction.
Yes, they will. I mean, you know, President Obama has a better reputation in most countries overseas than his Republican critics would give him credit for, although there is some criticism from some parts of the Middle East and other countries about some of the things he's done vis-a-vis Syria and some of the more thorny issues. But I think it's very difficult for him. I mean, back in the U.S., Donald Trump is a candidate who, whether you love him or you hate him, he's very difficult to pin down. His style of rhetoric, the content of his campaign rallies, his speeches, is so different from Obama. Obama is very careful and measured and nuanced, and Trump would say that that's actually something that allows other countries to walk all over America, which he frequently says. But the problem for other countries looking at Trump in comparison to someone like Obama is they don't know what they're going to get. There's a kind of a fear factor, which is, you know, this guy could do a lot of deals and it might be better than we expect, but we just don't really know what he's going to do. And that's why there's a kind of a feeling that we're in for a period of instability in the world if Donald Trump is elected president.
Samantha in Boston. Samantha, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm.
What's your thought?
Well, I'm really torn listening to this discussion about President Obama because I admire that he went to Hiroshima, and I think that was a good thing to do, except that as he's talking about a moral revolution that is necessary to accompany technological revolution, this is a president who has made ample use of drone strikes. And that is the most disappointing aspect of his presidency for me.
Samantha, our time is short before the break, but let me take it right there. Jack Beatty, the president calls for a moral revolution in the face of advancing technology, and yet, as Samantha points out, he himself is using that advancing technology in a pretty fulsome fashion.
Yes, and at the beginning of this week in Pakistan, in Balochistan, actually, striking at the leader of the Afghan Taliban in a very controversial strike that the Pakistanis just yesterday admitted had happened, and controversial because they have long denied that they were sheltering the Afghan Taliban. Now they're admitting it, but still saying, you know, we should have asked their permission. We didn't.
This nuanced president no doubt would say, well, better to take out one man with a drone than 100,000 with an atomic bomb. Where nuance goes in the next administration, we'll see. Jack Beatty, please stand by. Juana Summers with CNN. Dimitri Sevastopoulou with the Financial Times. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. Obama in Hiroshima. Trump clinches. Hillary wrapped on her emails. Bill Cosby will stand trial. Dimitri Sevastopoulou is with us from the Financial Times Washington Bureau Chief there. Juana Summers is with us from CNN Politics. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What is the weight to you of the State Department Inspector General's rebuke of Hillary Clinton's private email use this week? Republicans, are you now rallying around Trump, or are you still never Trump? Should Bernie Sanders debate Donald Trump? And are you glad for the president's opening to Vietnam? Are you with him on the TPP or not? Juana Summers, middle of this week, we had the State Department Inspector General report come out to Congress saying that Hillary Clinton should not have used a private email server to conduct official business, that if she had asked, she would not be allowed to do that. Also says she should have turned over all the emails after her tenure and that she'd violated department policy. The Hillary Clinton's people came back and said, as the report noted, other secretaries of state had done something along these lines. Does that clear her? Does this put her in deeper trouble? Where does the email issue stand at the end of this week?
So, Tom, for me, there are two separate issues here, and one of them I'm going to put aside for a second, and that's mm-hmm. the question of whether or not Hillary Clinton did anything wrong. The bigger question is that as we keep coming back and talking about these emails, there's a State Department IG investigation, there's the Justice Department that Hillary Clinton has said that she would be happy to talk to the Justice Department, FBI, whenever, and she has not spoken with them. The question is public perception. Even if Hillary Clinton did nothing wrong, she says she regrets it. She said she would have done something differently. There's this issue of, do voters trust her? Do they believe her to be honest? And the polling right now, 5 months out from the election, suggests that voters do not. So that's something that Hillary Clinton and her campaign are going to have to grapple with, because this is an issue that isn't going away. Republicans in Congress, Donald Trump, the presumptive nominee now, have said they're going to keep her up on this. And regardless of the fact that she's explained it as recently as yesterday, saying that she thought her email practices were allowed, that the rules in place at state were not, I think she used the phrase a model of clarity. This is something that voters are going to keep hearing about, and that if she wants to improve her public opinion in a race that could be close with Donald Trump, she's got to come up with an answer that can convince people.
Explain it or try to explain it away. I'm not sure which. Of course, yes, Trump jumped on it yesterday in Bismarck, North Dakota. No doubt he'll stay on it if it seems useful to him. Here he was.
It's devastating, the report. It's devastating. And there's no reason for it. It's just, you know, skirting on the edge all the time. And you look back at her history, and this is her history.
The Clinton campaign put out a statement saying that the Inspector General documents just how consistent her email practices were with those of other secretaries and senior officials at the State Department who also use personal email. How that went down, well, not so great. This was Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe yesterday saying, stop it. Stop trying to say it's all right.
I don't understand why you put out a statement like that. Stop digging. I screwed up. I'm terribly sorry. I hope the American people will forgive me, and I hope they will let us move on to the issues that matter. Stop lying. Stop digging.
Jack Beatty, stop digging, as in stop digging a hole for yourself here. Do you think Hillary Clinton's doing as well as she could with this issue? I mean, you know, it's hanging around. One sign of a politician's skill is how they get rid of issues like this.
Yes, and it's been her signature that she hunkers down instead of getting rid of things. This goes way back to Whitewater days, you know, non-disclosure, deal with everything in a legal way. That is, she and her lawyer, David Kendall, are careful about all that, although we'll see from the FBI whether legality was observed in this case. But they hunker down behind legal justifications, and she does not, she is not forthcoming unless forced to be. You know, today, Politico observed, it's a terrifying moment for Democrats. Terrifying because Hillary Clinton is within 78 votes, 78 delegates of the nomination, and probably will reach that on June 7th when New Jersey votes. And it's sort of a last, this email controversy is a last kind of reveille for Bernie Sanders. Do Democrats in California and elsewhere, is this a moment when they want to reconsider, when they want to, you know, judge that Hillary is so damaged or might be even more damaged by an FBI finding of security breaches, that that the Bernie Sanders argument that he's electable, she's not, that gains weight. They have a chance. This is what I think the next weeks are going to show. And now Bernie is up advertising in California. He wasn't last week. And Hillary is advertising, too. And she is slipping in the polls in California.
Dimitri, we see this latest average of polls from Real Clear Politics actually has Donald Trump by a very tiny margin, well within the margin of error, but by a very tiny margin, up over Hillary Clinton, 43.4 to 43.2%. Now, polls, schmolls, and it's early, and but as Juana says, there are only 5 months to go now. What do you make of that neck and neck in the latest polling average, Dimitri?
Well, I think if we just stand back for a second and think about June 16th last year when Donald Trump came down that famous escalator at Trump Tower. Golden escalator with his wife and gave that, you know, unorthodox speech about Mexican rapists and building the wall. And I think most people were laughing and most people, the vast majority of people, dismissed him as a joke candidate. And he's gone from strength to strength. And every time he's made what people thought was a faux pas, it hasn't impacted him. He's been Teflon Trump. When people said he had a ceiling of 40% of the Republican base, he said, well, that's not true because there's so many people in the field. I'm getting 30% with five people. I'm getting 40% with three people. And frankly, it turned out what he said was true. And, you know, then he started doing really well in New York and Pennsylvania. And all of a sudden, the narrative changed and people said, OK, we just now have to admit the fact he's probably going to be the nominee. And over the past month, I mean, since he became the presumptive nominee when he destroyed John Kasich and Ted Cruz in Indiana, he's gone from strength to strength in the polls. And now something that nobody thought was possible a year ago is happening, which is that in some polls, he's ahead of Hillary Clinton. And one of the interesting, if you dig into the numbers, one of the interesting things you find is the reason he's doing better than people expected is that independents, according to some of the polls, are flocking to him in bigger numbers than they are to Hillary Clinton. And I think some of that gets back to the issue that Juana was talking about earlier, which is that whether or not Hillary Clinton faces any kind of criminal jeopardy over the email saga, it does touch on this issue of whether she's trustworthy. And I think the drib drab of different reports coming out on the email saga over the next 5 months are really going to reinforce a narrative with her critics and some Democrats that she is not an honest person. And I think that's going to hurt her. And Donald Trump is going to hit her as Crooked Hillary every day from now till November 8th. So it's not going to go away.
It is just remarkable where this campaign has come. California coming up, and Clinton and Sanders are still quite close in the polling there. Bernie Sanders on Monday, this got a lot of play, saying that the Democratic convention this summer in Philadelphia could be messy. That sounded almost like a threat, but you have to hear how it went down. The AP asked him if it could be messy. Let's listen.
You think the convention could be messy?
So what? But democracy is messy. Every day of my life is messy. But if you want everything to be quiet and orderly and allow, you know, just things to proceed without vigorous debate, that is not what democracy is about.
Juana Summers, it could be messy. Democracy is messy. Is that a threat or just Bernie Sanders just telling it like it is?
You know, I have to admit, I thought that this one got a little bit overplayed. A lot of people took it to mean that we're going to see this bitter knockdown, drag out fight in Philadelphia. And I really didn't hear that. Look, there should be no shock to anyone that there have been some tensions between Bernie Sanders and the Democratic Party. He has routinely said that there is a system that is rigged against him with these superdelegates, that he believes it is a system that favors Hillary Clinton, that is against insurgent candidates. So I'm not surprised to hear him say that he thinks things in Philadelphia could be messy. This also comes the same week that we hear of the breakdown of how the different slots on the party's platform committee will be allocated, with Bernie Sanders getting five of those slots, Hillary Clinton getting six, giving him more influence on the Democratic Party's platform when we get to Philadelphia. But look, Bernie Sanders has made it clear from day one he wants to stay in this race until every state has had its vote, despite the fact that Hillary Clinton has a nearly insurmountable lead in both pledged and superdelegates ahead of him. So I really didn't take this as any sort of a threat. I think it's Bernie Sanders saying what Bernie Sanders has been saying all along. He is not going to go quietly into the night.
But of course, it could indeed still be messy. I mean, with that, the convention platform delegation, he's already put up a well-known advocate for Palestinian rights to help draft the Democratic policy statement there. That could put convention conversation to new territory. Tracy in Atlanta, Georgia. Tracy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I know one of your guests mentioned about the precedents on the emails. I mean, can she get a pass for this having been a precedent? And I feel that, yes, she should get a pass. I mean, I don't see what's so drastically different about what she's done and with what her predecessors has done. And I would think in any court of law, if the precedent has been set, then I don't understand the problem. Also, I think that really I feel like the Republican Party I guess those who oppose Hillary, I feel like it's really a smear campaign. I think, again, it takes us away from the real issues. It takes us away from issues on economy, on job, I don't understand why we're talking about these things and why we're talking about who uses what bathroom. This woman has shown that she has a great understanding of the world and of the economy, and that should be enough. Perception is not reality, as one of your guests said. I mean, the perception of Barack Obama is far from the reality. So I just don't understand why we keep having these conversations.
Why do you think Donald Trump shows up so close to her in the latest polls, Tracy?
I think just because some people are frustrated. I think they don't listen to. They don't want to be engaged in reality. They just want to be engaged in what they, you know, the smear, the reality TV. They don't take the time to really look at the issues. They don't take the time to think of the impact that someone like Donald Trump is going to have on this country and how we're viewed in the world.
Tracy, we've got it. I very much appreciate your call from Atlanta. If I may, let me pivot right off of that. I mean, there was this idea put forward this week of a Trump-Sanders debate, and Donald Trump saying if somebody will put up $10 million, the network or Sanders or anybody, he'll debate Bernie Sanders. Juana, can you see that actually happening?
I don't know if I would actually see that happening, although apparently Bernie Sanders said last night that ABC News had talked to him about it. Donald Trump claims all the networks are talking to him about it. I don't know if any networks are or not. But, you know, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders aren't campaigning against each other right now. Bernie Sanders is campaigning for the Democratic nomination against Hillary Clinton. So my question about that debate is kind of, you know, to what end? What does, from a kind of Schoolhouse Rock public service standpoint, what does this bring to voters who are trying to make their decisions in these contests? Right now, we have an unsettled Democratic race, so I perhaps would prefer to see a debate, as some others would, between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, who are still in a race against one another. We're not quite at the general election yet.
Yeah, okay. Of course, Bernie's saying he'd like to do that, too, in advance of California, and that's not happening. He's frustrated about that. Ben in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Ben, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hey, Tom. So really what I want to talk about is, you know, I do think that there might be an actual pretty high likelihood of that debate. Kind of what you got right now is this political rock, paper, scissors game where Hillary can beat Bernie, and then Bernie's going to beat Donald Trump, and then Donald Trump obviously beats Hillary, so you've got a little circle there. And if that debate were to happen, really it would just be beneficial for both candidates. I don't really see how it would hurt either or. It would probably just be more of a bashing Hillary kind of fest. Bernie would get his platform out there, and I don't really feel like it would hurt Donald Trump whatsoever.
I appreciate your call, Ben. We'll see how that turns out. I can imagine it actually happening in this year, this campaign year, where all kinds of unimaginable things are happening. Have there been attacks on Donald Trump? There sure have. Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts Senator, Democrat, of course, Tuesday night at a gala at the Center for Popular Democracy in Washington. She was very tough on Trump, saying that in 2006 he was drooling over the idea of a housing meltdown that would allow him to buy up real estate at rock-bottom prices. She asked what kind of man roots for people to get thrown out of their homes. Then she answered her own question.
It is a man who cares about no one but himself. A small, insecure money grubber who doesn't care who gets hurt so long as he makes a profit off it. What kind of a man does that? A man who will never be president of the United States.
Elizabeth Warren dishing it out hard. And what about Donald Trump's successes? Whoa, on the backs of others. Inherited, she said.
He inherited a fortune from his father, kept it going by scamming people, declaring bankruptcy, and then skipping out on what he owed.
Donald Trump, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, responded to the criticism that he was looking forward to a housing meltdown, said, hey, this is business. Here you go. Here's Trump.
She goes, and Donald Trump is a terrible person. And he wanted to buy housing when it was at a low point. Who the hell doesn't? Who doesn't?
And Donald Trump just kept swinging. As she ramped up her criticisms at that rally in Albuquerque, Trump responded calling Warren Pocahontas, a reference to her claims of some Native American ancestry.
Did you ever hear of Pocahontas? Huh? It's Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren. She was going out. She is probably the senator that's doing just about the least in the United States Senate. She's a total failure.
Jack Beatty, Elizabeth Warren emerging as a kind of a attack dog here in the campaign already. What role do you see for her in the months ahead?
Well, I think many Democrats felt a pang listening to her. Hillary Clinton also spoke to this issue this week, but comparatively feebly. She said, she talked about the taking advantage of the real estate crash, but then she said, and he went bankrupt. How do you manage to go bankrupt in the casino business? Making a feeble joke. People listening to Warren were thinking, why can't Hillary sound like that? And I think, you know, it helps put the issue in play, but it also underlines Mrs. Clinton's relatively weak performance on the stump, it seems to me. And, of course, any debate between Sanders and Trump, my gosh, that would just be poison for Clinton's chances, it seems to me. And it would greatly advantage Bernie. And the question for Sanders people is, with the prospect of Donald Trump on as president, is this the kind of thing they want to be doing at the 11th hour? It's a grave question.
Do you see any sign that Bernie is laying off? I mean, he still seems to be whipping that horse toward the line here, thinking maybe he's still got that chance.
I think so. I mean, he just he is not bringing his supporters around to recognizing what seems to be imminent reality. And he's still talking about the superdelegates as if that's a wholly illegitimate aspect of the Democratic nominating process. Remember, in 2008, Barack Obama won with the superdelegates. And Hillary does, if she gets over those 78, gets those 78 delegates before on June 7th, that's going to be with the superdelegates she'll be nominated. But in a sense, the superdelegates follow the real voters. She's got 3 million more votes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, 58 women have come forward and accused Bill Cosby of sexual abuse to date. Many of their allegations have run into statute of limitations restrictions on what can go to trial. Now Cosby will go to trial for one 2004 case involving Andrea Constant. Here's Heidi Thompson, another woman who said she was assaulted by Bill Cosby.
This is our case. I don't get a chance to face him in court for me. So Andrea Constand is doing it for all of us.
In the Saturday Night Live season finale, Larry David and Kate McKinnon reprised their famous impersonations of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton sitting in a bar at Last Call.
I'll have a beer. A new brand that people are flocking to. Something refreshing and revolutionary. Something that draws huge crowds.
And I'll have whatever beer no one likes but gets the job done.
And singer-songwriter Bob Dylan turned 75 on Tuesday. Here's his 1973 song, Forever Young.
May you always be courageous, stand upright and be strong. May you stay forever young.
Well, that was the prayer anyway. Listeners, you can join us. We're looking at a week in the news. Are you glad for the president's opening to Vietnam? Are you with him on the TPP? What do you think of the no convictions now for the first two police officers in the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore? Are you glad that Bill Cosby will stand trial? Is your state one of the 11 suing the feds over transgender bathroom policy? And how will you remember U.S. veterans, war dead, this Memorial Day weekend? Dimitri Savastopoulou is with us from the Financial Times Washington bureau chief there. Juana Summers, editor at CNN Politics, and our own Jack Beatty. People still thinking about the campaign. Ron in White Lake, Wisconsin. You're on, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hello, Tom and guests. Yeah, I'm disappointed in the kind of the pass that Hillary gets from the media. You know, and we hear over and over again this insurmountable lead in delegates, and, you know, that discourages people from going to the polls throughout this process to vote for Bernie. I'll give you an example. How come the media has not pressured Hillary to release those transcripts for her Wall Street speeches? You know, what promises did she make in exchange for all that money? Then the other thing, you know, everybody cites this 3 million lead in popular votes. Bernie won a lot of caucus states. Now, to my understanding, they do not release how many individual citizen votes make up those caucus groups. Can the media find that out and find out how narrow the real popular vote is? Because if you look at the AP and Politico list of those, they don't show how many people actually voted in those caucus states.
Ron, let us pick it up. Jack, I'll come first to you. You said the 3 million figure, and I've heard other Sanders people say, wait a minute, that's not fair. That doesn't take into account the caucus states. What about the argument, Jack?
That's a good argument. I hadn't thought of that. I'm not sure if that's true of all caucuses. And I do think the media, or at least pollsters, have ways of approximating the vote in those caucuses. And in any case, if we're talking caucuses, we're talking the least democratic way of selecting delegates. Bernie criticizes the superdelegates as undemocratic, and yet he has prospered, as Barack Obama did in 2008, on the least democratic way of selecting delegates, the caucus system.
Dimitri, you're at the Financial Times. You cover a lot of things at the Financial Times, including finance. Hillary Clinton gave big speeches to a lot of those firms. Why do you think she might not want to put those speeches out there now?
Well, I mean, by not putting them out there, she reinforces suspicions that she said things that will that either contradict her message in the campaign or that would not be appreciated by the average working class person in the country. And unless she puts the actual speeches out there, we're not going to know. And again, that reinforces this perception that she's not very honest with people. So I think that's one of the issues. I mean, the media do try and ask her about it, but one of the difficult things about covering Hillary Clinton is actually she does very few press conferences. So there are the kind of the ability for the average person in the media to question Hillary Clinton is much more limited than it is with even, frankly, Donald Trump. And it'll be interesting to see over the next 5 months, one of the challenges she's going to face is Donald Trump gets so much coverage on television. He phones in every day to multiple networks and to radio stations. And she's drowned out. So one of the ways that she could actually get more attention is to actually do more interviews and talk to more people. But whether she starts to do that or not remains to be seen.
In fairness, Donald Trump, he's got his own Let's See It, Donald, with the tax returns still not out there. Clintons are out there. That seems to me like a pretty big deal when you're running in part on the fact of your business expertise and your fortune, not to mention that this is just what the country's come to expect from people who want the highest office in the land. Another interesting kind of unusual thing this week was President Obama, while abroad, criticizing one of the candidates in this year's presidential election scene, and that would be Donald Trump, saying that Trump has rattled people, leaders around the world. Here's Obama in Japan.
They're rattled by him, and for good reason, because a lot of the proposals that he's made display either ignorance of world affairs or a cavalier attitude.
G7 leaders rattled by Donald Trump, says the president of the United States in Japan. Last night in Bismarck, North Dakota, Trump responded. Here he is.
When you rattle someone, that's good, because many of the world, as you know, many of the countries in our world, a beautiful world, have been absolutely abusing us and taking advantage of us. So if they're rattled in a friendly way, we're going to have great relationships with these countries. But if they're rattled in a friendly way, that's a good thing, John, not a bad thing.
That's a good thing, not a bad thing. Rattling allies. Dimitri, weigh in on that.
I think, well, from the allies' perspective, I think most of them would say that rattling allies is a bad idea. Your allies are your friends. Donald Trump likes to say that the Japanese and the South Koreans and the Europeans aren't doing enough to pay for their own security. And to be fair to him, in certain countries' cases, there's an element, in some cases a strong element of truth to that. However, the U.S. needs the allies as well. I mean, this is not a one-way street, and the U.S. is benefiting from these relationships in terms of preserving security. For example, in Asia, you have these huge shipping lanes where every iPad that's bought by an American goes through these shipping lanes. It's in the interest of Americans and people in Asia to have stability there. And allies and allied relationships help you do that. So I think the allies are concerned that Donald Trump is looking at this in a very through a very narrow lens and not appreciating the benefit that these relationships bring, frankly, to the whole world.
Dimitri, roll forward here for a moment on the G7 meeting itself. The president in Vietnam got a lot of attention, of course, because the United States, Vietnam, old adversaries, and him signing off on American arms deals coming down the pike for Vietnam as they go kind of eyeball to eyeball with China. Hiroshima got a lot of attention, and rightly so. But the heart of this visit was a G7 meeting where there's deep qualms about the global economy. Did these leaders, used to be the G8 with Russia, they're out now since the invasion of Ukraine, but did they come to any kind of consensus on how, I mean, after all, much of the world is not doing so well economically, the United States doing a bit better. Is there a consensus on how to move forward to keep the economy from tottering?
Not really. And the truth is, these meetings, they're given a huge amount of attention and they're flagged up as being incredibly important. And they are in the sense that it's, a rare opportunity that the seven leaders of these countries have a chance to sit in the same room and have frank discussions. But the truth is, a lot of what comes out from the meetings, especially in the communique that they always put out at the end, is fairly boilerplate. And there's relatively, there's certain things that governments can do to help the economy in terms of monetary policy. In most cases, there are independent central banks that are doing that, so the leaders have very little influence on that. The one place where they can do something is fiscal policy. And at the G7, Japan wanted a much stronger statement in terms of the major economic powers need to do more to stimulate their economies through fiscal stimulus. But Prime Minister Abe met strong resistance from both Britain and Germany. So he got a kind of a fig leaf type statement in the communique that helped him domestically. But the truth is that very little came out in terms of substance that the average person on the street would see and say, well, that makes a difference.
Why not? We had Donald Trump speaking of the economy. Maybe we go to energy in North Dakota yesterday. And talking about energy, of course, that is the heart of a lot of the American oil and gas boom. And he said, let's drill more and have fewer environmental regulations, and said he would cancel the Paris Climate Agreement if elected president. Said he would rescind Obama's climate change rules. He would revive construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, bringing that tar sands from Canada down to Gulf Coast refineries. Is that a vote? Is that a winning posture for Donald Trump now?
You know, I'm not sure. We've heard Donald Trump talk about energy, not just in North Dakota, where he was yesterday, but as we have had these coal country votes in Kentucky and in West Virginia to some extent as well. And just what we hear a lot about Donald Trump, from Donald Trump when he talks about policy, is all the things he doesn't like about what President Obama's done, what Democrats on Capitol Hill have done, about what he doesn't like about his rivals. But we don't hear a lot about what Donald Trump would actually do. So that is what I found particularly interesting about this speech. He talked about wanting to slash the Paris Agreement. His advisors have suggested that he would examine the role of OPEC and the global oil price slump. So this is the first we've really seen details from him. And the question is this a policy like many of Donald Trump's other policies that we will see evolve, that we will see change more over the weeks and months ahead as he's looking toward the general election?
Juana, he clinched the nomination with the 1237 number this week, and he did it with, as I understand, North Dakota delegates. Do you see a quid pro quo here? Is some like energy promise? For, you know, if I'm president, you can drill till the cows come home?
You know, I'm not sure if I do see a quid pro quo there, because you also have to take in the element of timing, too, right? Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has cleared the field, as you said earlier. Back in Indiana, he knocked Ted Cruz, John Kasich out of the race. We started out with 17 Republicans, and now there are just one. So this could, perhaps it could be tied to Donald Trump's energy policies, the work that he has done on the ground in North Dakota. But just as likely is the fact that Republicans see there's no one else there. He is, whether they love him or hate him, he is going to be the party's nominee, most likely. He is the presumptive nominee. He did go ahead and take on those delegates. I don't know, unless you're trying, you have some political capital of your own you're trying to save, I don't know what good it would do for those people to just, you know, not fall in line. And I'm sure that Donald Trump's team worked them very aggressively to make sure that they in fact did, so he could take this nomination now ahead of the convention rather than waiting and kind of getting those delegates once they get to Ohio.
Bruce in Westboro, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to guess your comment on the glaring double standard regarding trustworthiness applied to Clinton versus Trump. I mean, Trump has left a wake of lies and misstatements everywhere he goes. I mean, you remember back during the birther nonsense when he said he sent private investigators to Hawaii, and you won't believe what they found, and no one ever held him to it. And there's, you know, the whole Trump University scam. And, you could go on.
Bruce, our time is short, but let us pick it up. Jack, how about it? I mean, Hillary takes this trust rap, and yet you look at all these sort of accounts of Trump's truthfulness across a whole range of things. I mean, you know, it doesn't seem to stick. He says this today, that tomorrow, and on he goes.
It is remarkable, to use a neutral word. And I pointed out that in the past that Politico or the PolitiFact has found that the most accurate and truthful person on the campaign trail, this includes all the candidates, is Hillary Clinton. About half of her statements are true. We wish they would be higher than that. But with Trump, it's barely in single digits. I mean, he can't, if his mouth is open within 5 minutes, something false is going to come out. That has been documented by Politico, watching him over a week.
Monday, Reuters talked to a woman outside the courtroom where Baltimore police officer Edward Nero was acquitted of all charges in the 2015 death of Freddie Gray. Here she was.
It's just not fair at all to society. This is our city. They don't live here. We live here. They work in our city, and they're killing us and don't care.
Juana Summers, you know Baltimore. Now, this is the second. There will be no charges ultimately or conviction here. How's Baltimore dealing with this?
Well, I think it's kind of a hold your breath and wait and see. This is, of course, coming on the heels of the first trial for Officer William Porter, which in December resulted in a hung jury. And Baltimore, and as you noted, I live in Baltimore, mm-hmm. It has had a long history of tension between residents and the police, particularly among communities of color. This verdict in the case of Officer Nero, of course, doesn't mean that there will be no charges for all of these other officers who still have to stand trial. But I think that for many community activists, many who believe that members of the Baltimore police force are in fact responsible for the death of Freddie Gray back several years ago. We saw back a year ago when we had all this unrest. I think there's some concern there. Activists that I've spoken to say they're really concerned that the police department will get off scot-free, that nothing's going to change. And yet again, the communities who they're supposed to protect are being left by the wayside.
You've got 11 states this week suing the federal government over their directive on transgender bathroom policy and more. How do the odds of success of these states look, Juana? Are you following that?
I'm following it somewhat closely, less at the state level and more at the level of how we could see this shaping up at the Republican convention. I think with a Republican presidential nominee, Trump, who has expressed some openness, I believe he said that Caitlyn Jenner could use whichever bathroom she chooses at Trump Tower, that we could perhaps see conservatives within the party, such as a Ted Cruz, perhaps, or a Marco Rubio, kind of push that into a platform fight that I think could be very interesting at the national level, given the fact that Donald Trump's position is a bit to the left of some members of his party on this issue.
Well, a lot more to come there. Jack, can you imagine? I mean, a year ago, here we are, Sanders and Clinton, in their own still contest going on, despite the delegate numbers, and Donald Trump way out front and Hillary Clinton neck and neck with him in this latest poll average. It's just kind of incredible.
It is shocking, and it is a world turned upside down, at least in the political prognostication game.
Well, that's the game that we'll have some toe in, inevitably, in the months ahead. Jack Beattie, great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
Dimitri Savastopoulos at the Financial Times in Washington. Dimitri, very good to have you. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Juana Summers, editor at CNN Politics, covering the 2016 election. Juana, thank you as always. Great to have you today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can sign up for the On Point newsletter at our website, onpointradio.org. We've got a special Memorial Day weekend package there for you. You should really check it out. Our interview with Sebastian Younger from yesterday about American vets and American society. And check out the essay there, read by World War II 91-year-old vet Larry Kirby. Very moving. We'll go out with Bob Dylan, 75 this week, and still forever young, maybe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
May your feet always be swift. May you have a strong foundation. When the winds of change shift, may your heart